Okay, chapter 38, 39, and 40.
They built the altar of burnt offering of acacia wood 3 cubits high. It was square, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. They made a horn at each of the 4 corners so that the horns and the altar were of one piece, and they overlaid the altar with bronze. They made all its utensils of bronze, its pots, shovels, sprinkling bowls, meat forks, and fire pans. They made a grating for the altar, a bronze network, to be under its ledge, halfway up the altar. They cast bronze rings to hold the poles for the 4 corners of the bronze grating. They made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with bronze. They inserted the poles into the rings so they would be on the sides of the altar for carrying it. They made it hollow out of boards. They made the bronze basin and its bronze stand from the mirrors of the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Next, they made the courtyard. The south side was 100 cubits long and had curtains of finely twisted linen with 20 posts and 20 bronze bases and with silver hooks and bands on the posts. The north side was also 100 cubits long and had 20 posts and 20 bronze bases with silver hooks and bands on the posts. The west end was 50 cubits wide and had curtains with 10 posts and 10 bases with silver hooks and bands on the posts. The east side towards the sunrise was also 50 cubits wide. Curtains 15 cubits long were on one side of the entrance with 3 posts and 3 bases, and curtains 15 cubits long were on the other side of the entrance to the courtyard with 3 posts and 3 bases. All the curtains around the courtyard were of finely twisted linen. The bases for the posts were bronze. The hooks and bands on the posts were silver, and their tops were overlaid with silver, so all the posts of the courtyard had silver bands. The curtain for the entrance to the courtyard was of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and finely twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer. It was 20 cubits long and, like the curtains of the courtyard, 5 cubits high, with 4 posts and 4 bronze bases. Their hooks and bands were silver, and their tops were overlaid with silver. All the tent pegs of the tabernacle on the surrounding courtyard were bronze. These are the amounts of the material used for the tabernacle of the testimony, which are recorded by Moses' command by the Levites under the direction of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. Bezalel, son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, made everything the Lord commanded Moses. With him was Oliab, son of Ishmach, of the tribe of Dan, a craftsman and designer, and an embroiderer in blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and fine linen. The total amount of the gold from the wave offering used for all the work in the sanctuary was 29 talents and 730 shekels, according to the sanctuary shekel. The silver obtained from those of the community also was counted in the census. From those of the community who were counted in the census was 100 talents and 1,775 shekels, according to the sanctuary shekel. 1 bekah per person, that is half a shekel, according to the sanctuary shekel. From everyone who had crossed over to those counted, 20 years old or more, a total of 603,550 men. The 100 talents of silver were used to cast the bases for the sanctuary, and for the curtain, 100 bases from the 100 talents, 1 talent for each base. They used the 1,775 shekels to make the hooks for the posts, to overlay the posts, tops of the posts, and to make their bands. The bronze from the wave offering was 70 talents and 2,400 shekels. They used it to make the bases for the entrance to the tent of meeting, the bronze altar with its bronze grating and all its utensils, the bases for the surrounding courtyard and those for its entrance, and all the tent pegs for the tabernacle and those for the surrounding courtyard. From the blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, they made woven garments for ministering in the sanctuary. They also made sacred garments for Aaron, as the Lord commanded Moses. They made the ephod of gold and of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and of finely twisted linen. They hammered out thin sheets of gold and cut strands to be worked into the blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and fine linen, the work of a skilled craftsman. They made shoulder pieces for the ephod, which were attached to 2 of its corners so it could be fastened. Its skillfully woven waistband was like it, of 1 piece with the ephod, and made with gold and with blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and with finely twisted linen, as the Lord commanded Moses. They mounted the onyx stones in gold filigree settings and engraved them like a seal with the names of the sons of Israel. Then they fastened them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as memorial stones for the sons of Israel, as the Lord commanded Moses. They fashioned the breastpiece, the work of a skilled craftsman. They made it like the ephod of gold and of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and of finely twisted linen. It was square, a span long and a span wide, and folded double. Then they mounted four rows of precious stones on it. In the first row there was a ruby, a topaz, and a beryl. In the second row, a turquoise, a sapphire, and an emerald. In the third row, a jacinth, an agate, and an amethyst. In the fourth row, a chrysolite, an onyx, and a jasper. They were mounted in gold filigree settings. There were 12 stones, one for each of the names of the sons of Israel, each engraved like a seal with the name of one of the 12 tribes. For the breastplate, they made braided chains of pure gold, like a rope. They made two gold filigree settings and two gold rings, and fastened the rings to two of the corners of the breastpiece. They fastened the two gold chains to the rings at the corners of the breastpiece, and the other ends of the chain to the two settings, attached them to the shoulder pieces of the ephod at the front. They made two gold rings and attached them to each other, to the other two corners of the breastpiece on the inside edge next to the ephod. Then they made two more gold rings and attached them to the bottom of the shoulder pieces on the front of the ephod, close to the seam, just above the waistband of the ephod. They tied the rings of the breastpiece to the rings of the ephod with blue cord, connecting it to the waistband so that the breastpiece would not swing out from the ephod, as the Lord commanded Moses. They made the robe of the ephod entirely of blue cloth, the work of a weaver, with an opening in the center of the robe like the opening of a collar, and a band around this opening so that it would not tear. They made pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and finely twisted linen around the hem of the robe. And they made bells of pure gold and attached them around the hem between the pomegranates. The bells and pomegranates alternated around the hem of the robe to be worn for ministering, as the Lord commanded Moses. For Aaron and his sons, they made tunics of fine linen, the work of a weaver, and the turban of fine linen, the linen headbands, and the undergarments of finely twisted linen. The sash was of finely twisted linen and blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, the work of an embroiderer, as the Lord commanded Moses. They made the plate, the sacred diadem, out of pure gold and engraved on it like an inscription on a seal, holy to the Lord. Then they fastened a blue cord to it to attach it to the turban, as the Lord commanded Moses. So all the work on the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, was completed. The Israelites did everything just as the Lord commanded Moses. Then they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent and all its furnishing, its clasps, frames, crossbars, posts, and bases, the covering of ram skins dyed red, the covering of hides of sea cows, and the shielding curtain, the Ark of the Testimony with its poles and the atonement cover, the table with all its articles and the bread of the presence, the pure gold lampstand with its row of lamps and all its accessories, and the oil for the light, the gold altar, the anointing oil, the fragrant incense, and the curtain for the entrance to the tent, the bronze altar with its bronze grating, its poles and all its utensils, the basin with its stand, the curtains of the courtyard with its posts and bases, and the curtain for the entrance to the courtyard, the ropes and tent pegs for the courtyard, all the furnishings for the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and the woven garments worn for ministering in the sanctuary, both the sacred garments for Aaron the priest and the garments for his sons when serving as priests. The Israelites had done all the work just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Moses inspected the work and saw that they had done just as the Lord had commanded, so Moses blessed them. Then the Lord said to Moses, set up the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, on the first day of the first month. Place the Ark of the Testimony in it and shield the Ark with the curtain. Bring in the table and set out what belongs on it. Then bring in the lampstand and set up its lamps. Place the gold altar of incense in front of the Ark of the Testimony and put the curtain at the entrance to the tabernacle. Place the altar of burnt offering in front of the entrance to the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Place the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar and put water in it. Set up the courtyard around it and put the curtain at the entrance to the courtyard. Take the anointing oil and anoint the tabernacle and everything in it. Consecrate it and all its furnishings, and it will be holy. Then anoint the altar of burnt offering and all its utensils. Consecrate the altar, and it will be most holy. Anoint the basin and its stands and consecrate them. Bring Aaron and his sons to the entrance to the tent of meeting and wash them with water. Then dress Aaron in the sacred garments, anoint him and consecrate him so he may serve me as priest. Bring his sons and dress them in tunics. Anoint them just as you anointed their father, so that they may serve me as priests. Their anointing will be to a priesthood that will continue for all generations to come. Moses did everything just as the Lord commanded him. So the tabernacle was set up on the first day of the first month in the second year. When Moses set up the tabernacle, he put the bases in place, erected the frames, inserted the crossbars, and set up the posts. Then he spread the tent over the tabernacle and put the covering over the tent, as the Lord commanded him. He took the testimony and placed it in the ark, attached the poles to the ark, and put the atonement cover over it. Then he brought the ark into the tabernacle and hung the shielding curtain, and shielded the ark of the testimony as the Lord commanded him. Moses placed the table and the tent of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle outside the curtain, and set out the bread on it before the Lord as the Lord commanded him. He placed the lampstand in the tent of meeting opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle, and set up the lamps before the Lord as the Lord commanded him. Moses placed the gold altar in the tent of meeting in front of the curtain and burned fragrant incense on it as the Lord commanded him. Then he put the curtain at the entrance to the tabernacle. He set the altar of burnt offering at the entrance to the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and offered on it burnt offerings and grain offerings as the Lord commanded him. He placed the basin between the tent of meeting and the altar and put water in it for washing. And Moses and Aaron and his sons used it to wash their hands and feet. They washed whenever they entered the tent of meeting or approached the altar as the Lord commanded Moses. Then Moses set up the courtyard around the tabernacle and altar and put the curtain of the entrance to the courtyard. And so Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift up, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel during all their travels.
Any thoughts? Would be from approximately, I'd say, the seventh month to the end of the year, ready to be erected at the first day of the year. Because we talked about timing before. You know, you have these 50 days, and there's 40 days, and another 40 days. We're adding up time. There was a break between the two 40 days. I personally have it nailed down, but I'm not going to tell it because that's my thoughts, but that's all. Yes.
I have a question. Do you think that that's significant, the seventh month to the first day of the first month?
Obviously.
As a cycle and a prophecy to what's going to happen in the real deal? When he comes and we're setting up shop?
Yes, it can happen, but I'm not going to tell you because, see, the word of the Lord is not going to let, because he says, I will cut it short. Now, what does he mean by cutting it short? I don't know. We have plans. We think we got the timing. He says, I'm going to cut it short. Why? For the safety of those that are going to be killed. Okay, cut it short. That's hunky-dory with me. You know, that's my thinking. That's my thinking. All right. Any other comments?
Saying that the tabernacle is constructed from the inside out.
Primary, the first thing had to be constructed was what?
The tabernacle that
the
held
the ark had to be constructed first.
Oh, right.
All right. So for the inside out, okay.
Yes.
We're going right there, okay.
Yes.
Very good, very very good observation. Thank you.
I was just thinking about fruit and how there's a seed. You plant a seed.
Inside out.
Yes, and so the fruit of it. Of that tree is obviously going to have a seed on the inside.
Everything in creation is that way.
Yeah.
There's not exception to the rule.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yes, Bill.
There sure were a lot of commands. As the Lord commanded. As the Lord commanded. So it's very specific.
Yes. Well, it's important. Now, remember, we talked the word command, right? Told you what that word means in Hebrew, right? Doesn't mean law, it means a command. Just as you would with an officer over his troops. He gives them a command, and what do the troops do? Follow through until that command is completed. Then once the command is completed, the command is no longer there. Well, that makes sense to you?
But the things that he was having them make were so pretty.
Oh, yeah, of course.
What a beautiful design. Wow.
Wait, you went too far. Go ahead.
I noticed that the workers of the embroidery were men.
Right. But who made the threads?
The women.
Women.
The women, were,
the women did the threading. They did. They made the actual garments to be able to work with. Now, when the weaving is something different, okay, the weaving of the pattern must be on the curtains of the cherubim. Those had to be done by the ones that God said were going to do it, period, point blank. So he said, I have given these men this wisdom. One of us given the wisdom to be able to make the construction of many things, and the other was given wisdom to be able to do the embroidery or artistic design. That's the will of God, whether we like it or not. I happen to think he had reason for it, for a reason. But in the very first part of this thing, it was just they had too much stuff. And the women were doing a lot of work. A lot of... Don't think women sit back there taking care of the baby. No, they had to make the garments. They had to stitch the stuff together. They had to make the linen garments. What happened is, when you start putting decorations on it, certain things on it, then God says, I want this man to do that. And that's what happened.
The wall coverings were
made of linen.
Right, and then... To superimpose the embroideries on it?
Yes. They were weaved into them. It wasn't like a smooth garment, like we have, you know, a pattern we get from, you know, all this pattern. It comes from a special way of making it. But in those days, if you want a design on it, you had this flat piece of cloth made of linen. And if you want design on it, guess what? You got to stitch something in there to make it look like it's a design, okay? We're so used to modern times, we don't think, no. There was no dyes to make it special this way, that way, this way. The threads were dyed, all right? And they had to be weaved in a certain direction, in a certain pattern, a certain way. But to get the embroidery or the design of what's to be on the actual curtains of something entirely different, yes.
I just wondered what the value of the gold and the silver was in verses 24 and 25 of 38. It'd be like millions of dollars today?
I'm not going to tell you because I don't know. But on the other hand, with the rate of inflation, I mean, look at the value of gold today. 1,200 plus an ounce, troy ounce, you know. 20 years ago, it was $800 bucks an ounce. 20 years before that was $300. And way back during what's-his-name president, it was 35 cents an ounce. So it has no real value. Gold has, we should not be looking at how expensive it was, but the very fact that the gold does say something to us. It's a precious metal. Period. Point blank. Now, back in those days, stop, put yourself into their shoes. Unlike we have billions of human beings on the face of the earth, the amount of gold has not increased from creation. Just people. So the gold gets spread out, thinner, 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 thinner. Because a lot of people got gold now. I got gold, you got gold, everybody got gold. But back then, when you had gold, you had a lot of it. And when you read how much gold they had to make the garments, or to make the thing, they had a lot of gold. And it was something that God did not use for exchange of monetary system. He used it for one reason, to make things to have to do with his dwelling place. Yeah.
I just wondered what a shekel was and a talent.
Oh, you have to maybe look at my book. Anybody else know right off the top of their head? Well, apparently not. All right. Let's put this way. In relationship to this, what year this Bible was built, I don't know when. If I could find it real quickly. Was what?
Four
troy ounces. Okay.
Sorry.
Point four troy ounces. Very, very small. Not very much. Women had earrings. You know, they weren't 40 pounds there. They were troy ounces. Very, very small. It's smaller than what you would normally think an ounce to be. All right. It's how you measure things like metals and how you measure things of rocks or diamonds, anything, is measured based upon a different weight than you would have for in your kitchen. You have, you know, a cup that says 7 ounces. Yes.
75 pounds for a talent.
Yeah. But, no, wait, be careful. She's talking. Let's see, when was this book published, Ellie? Yeah, same year I did. And I don't know, what year was it, 1948? See, it published 1985. That's ancient days now. It's probably, according to inflation, at least 10 times of 100 times more than that today. Had no value, see. What value is, what is it that God wanted it used for? Okay? So we can't really weigh it out by what its value is of today. Yes?
To me, the value of it is that these people gave so much that Moses had to tell them, back off.
Yes, you know, yes.
That's what we should focus on, I think, a little bit here, as opposed to, oh, you know, $75,000 or $100 million.
It tells you that God, that even the men who were having too much coming, they said, enough's enough. Go home. And they had to restrain them. I mean, how would you, as a person, when people giving you money, and this pile up over here is behind your back, and you're safe, and they keep putting money, you say, keep coming, or would you say, enough's enough? And would you bring in the police to stop them? No, you wouldn't, because you say, oh, I'll build a bigger safe. But see, that's not how God thinks. Enough's enough. I don't need any more. The end. Yes.
Well, in the Holy Jerusalem, the walls are made out of gold. So it's just no more, it's worthless. Like concrete.
That's transparency, too. It's pure. It means it's pure. It's a purity within it. Okay. Now, we have gone through the 35th, 36th, 37th, 38th, and 39th chapter. We'll get to the 40th one in a minute. Why was it important to restate everything that we had read before when God talked to Moses on the mountain the first time? Why was it so important? Why couldn't they just say, next paragraph, and they did all God, Moses told, saw the mountain, the end, and we go from 35th chapter to the 40th chapter and forget about stuff in between. Yes?
Well, I don't know if this is the answer you're looking for, but God always gives two places. He gives two witnesses of the things in here. And I think maybe, I don't know whether it's because one might have gotten it wrong, or whether the fact that to make the point that that was the instruction.
And what actually took place? They actually did it. That's the point. It's not just a statement. They went into detail. Look how their heart was in it. And remember, this is the second time when Moses came down from the mountain. Not the first time. They still had a real, not a good attitude. And they obeyed the second time, and they waited. And their heart, he says, those who have their heart to do this. He didn't command them, by the way. Thou shalt give me your earrings. He said, you who have a heart and want to do this, give it unto me. So we see these people. We don't know how many. I'm not going to tell you how many, because I don't know how many. I wasn't there. Plus, on top of all that, you look at this thing, and they're saying, do you think God was upset with them? Oh, no, they carried out. They actually did it. Now, when you, in your world, you're... Okay, let me put it this way. You know that I try very hard to say your faith must be based on something that's concrete, not abstract, right? And so, when you look at something that is concrete, you have something that you can actually know is true. Now, let me ask you something that's very, very concrete. Do you believe with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your being, that if you jump off a big, big building, you'll fall down? Why do you know that? Did somebody do it? You say, oh, look, you know, the evidence was there so obvious. You say, wow. He didn't fly. He's dead, you know. And so that's concrete. And so therefore you have hope in that you will not fall off because you're not so dumb enough to try it, all right? But now you're acting on what you have knowledge before you. The simplicity of the matter, right? Now, when you're having here, God wanted them to build a tabernacle. Well, you know, God lives up there in heaven, and he rolls around heaven all day with the sun and the moon and the stars. Why does he need a place? I mean, didn't he tell David, what are you doing that for? No. He actually was very, very pleased. And I'll tell you, if you build a tabernacle, the dwelling place, internally within you, and you just instead of saying, well, I just believe, I have hope, and go off and do something else, he wants to see you physically do it. In your world, in every aspect of your physical world, how you live, how you walk, how you talk, what you do with your hands, everything you do, if it's in relationship to, what did I think Apostle Paul said it, I may be wrong, something near nature, you're working for the Lord. Everything you do, you're working for the Lord and not yourself. We say, well, wait a minute. I have to go out and I have to work. I have to make a living. I have to bring in my food, clothing, shelter for my family, my kids. But, well, no. Priority is work for God first. And here we have all these people of Israel building something where God can live in. Not according to how they would like it, but how God would like it. And so when we look at this tabernacle, and we see these people with all of their being, every one of them with their soul, and their heart, their mind, their spirit, dwelling on and working with those who had a heart for God, wanting to put it together, they didn't just sit there and say, oh, I have a heart for God. I love God. I love God. I'm a lover of God. And does nothing. What does that tell God? Nothing. It tells God nothing, really. It tells him, oh, really? A lot of words. Where's your action? What Apostle James saying? Show, huh? Faith without works is dead. All right. You've got to do something, okay? We say, well, I'm not going to work because that's not having faith. Well, wait a minute, James. Back then, during the Apostle James' time, guess what? The same stupid argument was there as it was way back at the time Moses, and well it is today. All we have to do is love God. Well, is that all? Oh, no, you got to build something. You got to build something. Right? So, I think when I read these things, the 35th, 36th, 37th, 8th, through 9th, and 40th chapter, although it's a period of a lot of repetition, no, it's a period of time where people actually did it. That should tell us something. What does the Apostle Paul say? They're written there for our admonition, for our instructions, for a pattern for us to follow. Right? So we say, well, build a big, huge, giant cathedral. Wait a minute. That's not what was taking place there at all. What do? They built a place, a dwelling place for God. We know what the New Testament says. And my question to you is saying, okay, since we are the, quote, dwelling place, end of quote, how should it be arranged? According to that which is pleasing to us, or according to that which is pleasing to God? The 40th chapter. The last chapter of the book of Exodus. Moses did something. What did he do? Yahweh said unto Moses, saying, on the first day of the first month you shall set up the tabernacle of meeting. Then he tells them precisely where to put everything in the precise location. Now, believe me, I think Moses had help. I think he couldn't do it all by himself. He had a crew. We know the book of Deuteronomy, 10th chapter, that's what the men did. They were actually doing the work they did. They put the thing together. They staked it in place. He wasn't the only one out there. But it came to the anointing of the oil. I believe he did the anointing. That's my personal belief. I don't think it was done by Aaron, because Aaron was not yet anointed yet. And it says, Moses, by the word of Creator, heaven and earth, says, I am making you an Elohim, and Aaron is your prophet. So Elohim does the action first, the prophet follows through. It's the same pattern we have with the Father and the Son. The first thing he says, verse 3, you shall put the ark of the testimony in the portion off in the veil. That's where you're supposed to put it. First priority is where do you put this thing? It's the inner. Like it's the inner inside. Put that first, because that, why is that so important? It's the mercy seat. What's that for? Kindness, showing God is kind and merciful. Yes, there's a testimony. Yes, there is a witness there. Yes, there is a witness, thou shalt not. This commandment, this is my command, my command, my command, my command. By the way, those commandments are still in action. They have not been completed yet. They will be completed. Yes?
It's also a place for him to rest.
Okay, look at it, yeah. It's where he lives. And here, the Messiah, life was killed because that curtain in front, right? Now, that was ripped open. What did the book of Hebrews say? Now, we get to go into that very dwelling place, that place where the Creator of heaven and earth is at. I found it very fascinating. The book of Hebrews centers in on the tabernacle. Then it centers in on the temple. Tabernacle first. Tells us, wow, look at this. And so sometimes, I think the author of Hebrews is trying to regroup those people who are so accustomed to, I want to say fanfare, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but the ceremonies of the temple, that they really had missed the beginning of it. What was it all about in the very first place? Why is it that God wanted it this way? Okay, that's my thinking. And so he went through there, and he went and he anointed all of them. Now, the first thing is where's the testimony put? Where's the lamp going to be? Next thing in line was the lamp. Lampstand on the menorah. Where is that going to be placed? And so on and so forth, all the way through down the line. And then it came to pass on the first day, first of the second year, the first day of the month, the tabernacle was raised up. It was there. But in exact, precise order. I find that kind of awesome when you stop and think about this. That tabernacle meant something very, very important to the Creator of heaven and earth. Otherwise, it had no value. It's meaningless, right? If it didn't mean anything to him, then why should we even read about it? But it's not. Significant value to him. And he saw the heart of the people. Now he anoints it with certain kind of oil. And he's anointing. We read about the oil. I'm not going back to find out because I forgot to write it down. But nonetheless, you know, certain oil was, everything was used. No blood was put on this one yet, right? No blood, just oil on everything. That oil was very special oil. And was not to be used for anything else except for the anointing of the tabernacle and the things and the instruments within it. And, of course, anointing Aaron himself and his sons. That's what it was for. Now, when you put it in the line with the Messiah, Yeshua, what do you see? Is there something here that you can kind of say, you know, this really is the picture of the Messiah? What is the picture of the Messiah here?
Oh, I don't have an answer to that question.
Okay.
I was thinking.
When was the Messiah anointed? Is there a way? Before he died, he was anointed for his death. But was he anointed before?
Anointed with what? It doesn't oil. Oil is not representation of the Spirit of God. What is the representation of oil? What is the representation of this oil to anoint that which is to be holy? Sorry, what? The Torah is a lesson. I'll say what?
Mary.
But that was his mother. Okay, Mary. Mary the mother. Not okay, you got it now. Okay, so we have at the very beginning here, the Messiah was anointed with oil by his mother first. That's his first anointing. You missed it, didn't you? We probably thought, okay, what she did, she put it over here and she tucked it under her pillow and only used it in case of emergencies. Wait a minute. No, she used it then. She anointed him then. That was the first anointing he took. First anointing he had. He was anointed to be a holy man of Israel. He was anointed to be the Holy One of God. He was anointed to be the Messiah at the hand of his mother. Isn't that awesome? Mary was given two oils and gold. Right. She used the oils not on herself. It was a gift unto the Son and the King. And they came to visit the King of Israel. They didn't come to visit a baby who was kind of cute. Alright? I don't know what they were. It doesn't say what they were. It says four men or three men or five men or 20 men. It doesn't say how many men came and they gave this to. I don't think it was. I'm sorry. My wife's got the little tiny bottles. I don't think they're little tiny bottles that they got from Young Living Oil up there in Oregon. I mean, I don't think so. They would have brought a barrel full, not really a barrel, but they would have brought a lot of oil. Expensive oil. It doesn't matter how expensive it was. It was for the anointing of. Now, when Aaron was anointed as high priest, what does the apostle, it was David in the book of Psalms. I don't know if David said that. All the way down, garment got soaked. So I'm thinking, I wasn't there. I'm just saying, okay, was Jesus kind of like, you know, a little bit of oil on your forehead there? Or did he put oil on him all over his body? Every aspect of his body. Well, I got it. She did that. Because she knew what it was for. You know why she knew it was for? Because what Gabriel said to her in the book of Luke. This is the one. Wow. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? Right. Connected also to Jerusalem, to the king. He had both lines. But do you understand a little bit now, I hope? Now, so God was preparing the tabernacle and anointing the tabernacle with all of these oils, every aspect of it, because his son was going to dwell there. His son had to go into a place that was holy and clean and pure. Wow. How important is the tabernacle? This is the reason, you know, I go through, but hopefully next week we have the Peace Trumpets. By the way, if you got a shofar, bring it. For the fun of it. Just bring it. But anyway, just lost my train of thought. That happens to me now and then. Actually, it happens to me quite often. I'm sorry, what? Right. What was I thinking? Oh, well. It doesn't matter. But I think it's very fascinating that this tabernacle had to be erected and finished. Yes?
Well, since you were talking about trumpets, by the way, trumpets around the world will blow their trumpets at 8 o'clock on next Friday evening. So if you're in a place to blow it, because as the time changes, it'll be blowing around the world. I think it's 8 o'clock. Yeah, something like that.
I have on my one of the anointing thing. I don't remember where it was. I got lost on the track. All of a sudden, I talked about Feast of Trumpets, and I talked about the anointing. Anyway, when we are being able to be anointed with the oil, we will be anointed with the right oil. We will be. You are merged within the spirit of the Creator of heaven and earth. That's different. You're living within Him. You're living within that spirit of the Creator of heaven and earth. The Father Himself. When it comes to oil, it's everything around about you, as it was at the temple, the tabernacle, everything had to be ready, made perfect, made holy, made according to what He had in mind when He told Moses, see that you do it exactly like I have said to be done. It wasn't just a place for the Father to live. It was a place for the Messiah to live. Because we know one thing in the book of Revelations. He is the one who makes the judgment. He also said that in the book of John. The Father's not going to judge anybody. I'm going to do it all. So in a sense, it's Him going to sit on that mercy seat. And we'll come before Him. All right. I hope we learned something from the book of Exodus. Now I know what I'm going to say. That's why I said next week is going to be... When we come back after the Feast of Trumpets, we got one Shabbat before we go to the Feast, before we have Day of Atonement and go to the Feast of Tabernacles. I'm going to try my very, very best to put an overview of the entire book of Exodus. The reason why, I think it's one of those, it's not just a book, it's one of the important books that tells us a picture, shows us a picture, shows you what God did, what God had in mind, what God was going to do, what He will do in the future. All in that particular book. And it's massive, it's huge. And it's more than just, Exodus, they left Egypt. And the plagues, yeah, we got that. Oh my. That's a small section of everything. It's really just a section. Had to happen, yeah. Listen carefully. Moses was 40 years old when he killed the Egyptian. He was 40 years later, God brought him back. 40 years after that, he's dead. 120 years. Or 40-year period. That is that's a prophetic thing and not just a happenstance. We will get there when we will get there. But I just want you to keep this in mind because I think it's very, very important that we pay attention to why. Where does 120 years relate to? In the book of the little one, the one before it, the one called Bittersheet. No, not really. Specific time period, yes.
I'll only contend with man for 120 years.
Okay, now that's not technically how it is in Hebrew. No, it's okay. 120 is 40. Wait, it's 40 and 40 and 40. Very important that we break it in 40, 40, and 40. This had to do with a prophecy that lasts a whole lot longer than 120 years. Much longer. This prophetic statement goes way into the concluding end of mankind on this earth. Yes.
Well, that can also be understood to be 120 generations. And they figure there's 50-year segments, which is 6,000 years of time. So 120 years can be read in a couple of different ways in Hebrew.
But then we have a guy named Shem. Did he die 120 years after the flood? Oh, no, many years later. And his brothers, many years. No, God didn't. That thing of contending and striving with man has to do with prophetic statement. That's what Genesis is telling us in the future. It tells us what's happening in the future by telling us at the very beginning what's going on. Some of you missed that when I was going through Genesis. That's okay. Go back and read it and see if you can't understand a little bit more. And ask God to help you see things.